Case is submitted. We'll hear argument next in number 86393, United States against James B. Stanley. Mr. Wright, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, in the 1950s, the Army conducted tests regarding the effects of LSD, and respondent was one of the servicemen who participated in those tests. He alleges that he was secretly administered LSD on four occasions in February 1958 at the Army's Chemical Warfare Laboratories while he was supposedly testing gas masks, and that he did not know he had been given LSD until 1975, when the Army asked him to participate in a follow-up study. He alleges that he sustained mental injuries as a result of taking the drug. The procedural history of this case is noteworthy because it shows that respondent gave up on both of his claims during the course of this litigation. Respondent's original complaint, which alleged a claim under the Federal Tort Claims Act, was dismissed by the district court on the basis that respondent had been injured incident to military service, and the Fifth Circuit in 1981 held that that claim was barred by this court's decision in Ferris. Respondent filed an amended complaint that contained an FTCA claim and a Bivens claims as well, but the district court dismissed the FTCA claim and granted final judgment in favor of the United States. Respondent did not appeal the dismissal of the FTCA.
Well, Mr. Wright, when you say granted final judgment, was there ever a judgment ordered in compliance with the separate document requirement? Was that Rule 58?
Yes, Your Honor. It's printed at pages 54 to 55 of the appendix to our petition. The judge entered wrote an opinion, which is printed at pages 56 to 66. And then he entered this two-page order, which says that there is no just reason for delay in expressly directing the entry of judgment in favor of the United States, and that such relief is hereby granted. And I'd like to note that hereby granted is printed in all capital letters. That is about as plain a final judgment under Rule 54B as there can be.
Well, but how about the separate interim requirement of Rule 58?
Well, we contend that this order is a separate
document.
You say
document. It satisfies both.
Yes, the purpose of the rule is that there should not merely be some apparently dispository language in the opinion, as there is in the opinion that's printed on pages 56 to 66, but that there should be a separate order that complies with the rule. The government asked the district court to enter this final order pursuant to Rule 54B, dismissing the United States, and the district court did. Respondent didn't appeal that dismissal, as he was required to do, but instead filed a second amended complaint, which is the live complaint in this case, and which is printed.
Before we leave that point, Mr. Wright, I guess the respondent argues that on this same order you refer us to, in the next paragraph, it says further order that the clerk enter final judgment in favor of the United States, that the clerk never did.
The clerk is required to enter final judgment on the docket sheet, and we've printed that in page 2 of our joint appendix. And if I may quote from it, it says, motion for partial final judgment by defendant USA is granted.
That's in the appendix also.
That's in the joint appendix.
Yes.
But you didn't read it all. That's the motion is granted. Then it says the clerk to enter final judgment in favor of U.S. Is that right? Maybe I'm reading the wrong thing.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
What does that mean? Doesn't it mean there's something more to be done?
Well, we don't think that there was anything more to be done. That's tracking the language of the order that the judge entered. The judge said, final judgment is hereby granted. The clerk shall enter the order. The clerk then said, final judgment is granted, and repeated that the clerk to enter final judgment. There was never any dispute that final judgment was entered. In the letter that counsel for respondent wrote to the district court after this court's decision in Chapel v. Wallace, counsel said, you entered judgment in favor of the United States in this case a few months ago. The 11th Circuit in this case acknowledged at the beginning of its opinion that final judgment was entered in favor of the United States. There's simply never been any real doubt about that. And in the face of a statement in the order saying final judgment in favor of the United States is hereby granted, we just don't think there can be any real dispute on that. And it's further shown that respondent understood that by the fact that he filed a second amended complaint that contained Bivens claims, but no FTCA claim. Then this court issued its decision in Chapel v. Wallace, and respondent wrote the letter to the district court that we reprinted in our reply brief at the petition stage that says that counsel was, quote, ethically compelled to cite to the court a recent Supreme Court decision which, we regret to say, is apparently dispositive of this case, unquote. The district court refused to accept that concession, although it did certify its order to that effect for interlocutory appeal. The Court of Appeals affirmed that decision, and then, ignoring the fact that respondent had abandoned his FTCA claim, resurrected that claim as well. We contend that the Court of Appeals should have dismissed respondent's Bivens claims and should not have resurrected the FTCA claim, because this Court's decisions in Ferris and Chapel compel the conclusion that servicemen injured incident to military service may not pursue those sorts of claims. We realize that under the result that we contend is mandated by this Court's decisions, respondent is barred from challenging an Army program that was poorly conducted and that may have harmed him. But respondent is not without a remedy. As we've explained in our briefs, if he was injured as a result of this program, he may obtain veterans' benefits. And the Army is not vindicated by a decision holding that he may not pursue damage actions. The Senate has studied the Army's LSD testing program and issued a critical report concerning that program that included instructions to the Army as to how to conduct future chemical weapons tests. Concerning the final judgment entered in favor of the FTCA claim, I'd like to note only that the whole point of Rule 54B is to resolve a case as to certain issues or as to certain parties, and that this case was resolved in favor of the United States when respondent decided not to appeal that final judgment. In addition, I'd like to note that the 11th Circuit's jurisdiction in this case was based on its acceptance for interlocutory appeal of the question certified, which was the Bivens question. And the FTCA question was clearly beyond the scope of that certified question.
Are there decisions in the courts of appeals as to whether or not the jurisdiction of the Court of Appeals on a certified question extends only to the certified question, or whether its jurisdiction extends to the whole case?
There are such decisions. We've cited a number of them. It is sometimes difficult to draw precisely the line as to where the certified question ends and other matters begin. But I know of no case that would even come close to the situation here, where it's an order as to another party on another claim. We don't know of any case that would allow a court to extend its jurisdiction on a certified question under these facts. Finally, on that point, I'd just like to note that the 11th Circuit didn't even appear to be aware that there was a jurisdictional problem, although we did raise that in a rehearing petition that they denied. In any event, as to the FTCA claim, it's clear that that claim is barred by Ferris because respondent was administered LSD incident to his military service. In its 1981 decision in this case, the 5th Circuit noted that in 1958, respondent was a master sergeant in the Army who had volunteered to participate in an official Army chemical warfare program, that the program was conducted on an Army base by and for the benefit of the Army, that respondent received military pay during the month that he participated in the program, and that he was promised a letter of commendation for his participation. I might add as well that in the second amended complaint in paragraph 11, respondent says that he was on active duty during that month. No court has disagreed with the conclusion that respondent was participating in this program incident to his military service, and not even the 11th Circuit. It instead held that an FTCA claim is not necessarily barred because the injury on which the claim is based occurred incident to military service. We argued in Johnson, the FTCA case involving a helicopter crash that was argued in this court in February, that this court held in Ferris, shortly after the FTCA was enacted, that Congress did not intend to waive sovereign immunity for torts occurring incident to military service, and that there's no reason to revisit that construction of the statute, which Congress has not seen fit to alter in 37 years. I won't repeat that argument today, but do want to note that this case represents a significant extension of the 11th Circuit's erroneous decision in Johnson, which distinguished Ferris on the basis that the tortfeasor there was a civilian air traffic controller who was not in the military chain of command, but was instead employed by the Department of Transportation. There is no question that the program under which respondent was administered LSD was an Army program. It was developed and conducted by the Army Intelligence Board and the Army's Chemical Warfare Laboratories, where the tests were conducted. While respondent has named some civilian doctors in his second amended complaint, they were obviously working for the Army in this case. The courts below also erred in refusing to dismiss respondent's Bivens claim. The letter that counsel for respondent sent to the district court after this court issued its decision in Chapel v. Wallace explained that this court, quote, held that the same principles which underlie the Ferris Doctrine and which require absolute immunity from an FTCA action also require immunity from a Bivens constitutional action against federal officers, unquote. That is an accurate description of this court's holding. Except for the courts below, all of the other courts of appeals that have considered the question have understood that this court barred servicemen from bringing Bivens suits against their superiors and did not authorize any case-by-case inquiry of the sort mandated by the court below. That's absolutely clear from this court's opinion in Chapel, which reversed the Ninth Circuit opinion that didn't authorize the plaintiff to bring their Bivens action, but instead remanded the case for application of certain tests similar to those set out in the Fifth Circuit's Mendez v. Seaman case, to determine whether the plaintiffs there could proceed. This court rejected that balancing approach, holding instead that enlisted military personnel may not maintain a suit to recover damages from a superior officer for alleged constitutional violations, a holding that the district court here described as an overbroad statement. The courts below relied on this court's statement in Chapel that military personnel are not barred from all redress in civilian courts for constitutional wrongs. The courts obviously misread that statement, which was followed by citations to three cases that did not involve claims for damages. As at least three other courts of appeals have concluded, This court in Chappell clearly held that servicemen may not pursue Bivens actions while indicating by the statement relied on by the courts below that in some cases they may grant other sorts of relief. We don't think that courts should frequently grant other sorts of relief to military personnel, but we acknowledge that this court has left open that possibility in extreme cases. Proceeding to their case-by-case inquiry, the courts below concluded that the concerns underlying Ferris and Chappell are not relevant here because respondent was not ordered to take LSD. While we do not think that any case-by-case inquiry is warranted, it's nevertheless clear that the courts below erred in reaching their conclusion. The concerns underlying Ferris are not limited to cases involving direct orders, and it's not clear where the district court got its contrary idea. This court's decision in Ferris, nor this court's decision in Shearer, nor most of the Ferris cases in between, involved any sort of direct order. This court's made clear that the rule of Ferris is based on the principle that the military is under the control of the political branches and that the judiciary should generally not review military decisions since such litigation would undermine military discipline and effectiveness. This court's decision in Shearer is particularly instructive. The court there concluded that a claim against the Army based on its alleged failure to discharge or supervise a serviceman who had previously been convicted of manslaughter would require the courts to review a decision of command and would call into question basic choices about the supervision and control of servicemen. It could not be more clear that this case involves such questions. The heart of respondents' claim is that the Army should not have been using servicemen to study the effects of LSD and that it made a number of mistakes in the way it conducted those tests. Respondent is therefore challenging decisions of command and calling into question basic decisions made by the Army in the 1950s concerning the use of military personnel. His claims are therefore barred. If there are no further questions, I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. We'll hear now from you, Mr. Kupfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. If the plaintiff in this case had volunteered for LSD drug testing on behalf of the Army, the government would have a much stronger argument that this was something that was incident to his military service, but that's not what happens in this case. The plaintiff did not volunteer for LSD drug testing. The plaintiff, nor was he under orders to arrive at Edgewood Arsenal for LSD drug testing, nor was he even on his regular duty status for that one-month period of time that he was up at Edgewood Arsenal. With the Court's indulgence, what I'd like to do, if I could, is spend the first few minutes just discussing some of the unique facts of this particular case, which I think make this case unlike any other Ferries type of case which has been before this Court previously. He did not volunteer for LSD drug testing. He did not. The plaintiff volunteered in this case for a program that was ostensibly supposed to test and develop gas masks right. and protective clothing. Right. That was the purpose of the program. That was the lure to attract Mr. Stanley up to Edgewood Arsenal. There was no compulsion for him to go up there. When he did go up there, they went through the charade of having him test gas masks and protective clothing. But the real purpose of this program was to unwittingly subject the plaintiff to LSD, which was secretly added to his drinking water while he was up at Edgewood Arsenal.
Is it alleged in the complaint that he and he alone received the LSD or that others in the same program received it?
We have not alleged that others in the same program received it. We've just alleged that he alone received it. At any time that he desired, he could leave the testing laboratory.
Did you say that he alone, or did you just say that he received it?
We've just alleged that we did not make allegations that other soldiers also received it, Justice Rehnquist's question. Our allegations go entirely to this
one
point.
Well, I think there's a lot of difference between saying that he alone received it or that he received it. I just wanted to be certain.
I'm not saying that he was the only person who received it. I'm just saying that we have not made any allegations in our complaint that go outside the facts of Mr. Stanley's situation up at Edgewood Arsenal. At any time he desired, he could leave that program. There is no evidence in the record as to what his technical duty status was while he was up at Edgewood Arsenal. There is no evidence that there was any disciplinary relationship between the plaintiff.
Was he?
There is no evidence what he was on. That's that. There is no. I don't believe the record indicates.
You mean he went up there for rest and recreation?
No, he went up. He went up there to volunteer for a program that was misrepresented to him. He went up to volunteer for a program.
Whatever the program was, it was part of the army, though, wasn't it?
Well, it was whether or not that was an army program is also in dispute because the complaint alleges otherwise. Okay, the complaint in this case.
Well, how did anyone ever ask him to volunteer or give him the opportunity? Who asked him or who
there was
available to him?
There was a notice that was posted at his army barracks.
Why are you suing the army if you're not sure it's an army program? I thought that everyone was in agreement on that.
We're not. We're not suing the army. We're suing the United States, and we're suing civilian officers. We're suing doctors who were civilians. We're suing the state university, which is alleged to have been an independent contractor. We are suing individuals who we say were employed by federal civilian agencies, such as but not limited to the CIA, that we say implemented and was part of this program. We are not suing Army officers as part of this program, which is, again, one of those unique facts that I started out saying, which I think distinguishes this.
Well, he didn't get leave, did he, from Army duty for this program?
The complaint alleges is that he was no longer on his active duty service for the time he was up there, that he returned back to his active duties after the month. I don't believe there's anything in the record as to what his duty status was when he was up there. That's a question mark.
But he was still in the Army.
He was still in the Army, yes. Now, Mr. Wright has pointed out in his brief that, well, he was still receiving military pay while he was up there for that 1 month. But a soldier who's on furlough receives military pay for 1 month also. This court has held in the Brooks case that a soldier on furlough is allowed to sue the government under the Federal Tort Claims Act for negligence. The plaintiff in this case was given false information as to the program. The dosage of LSD that he received is unknown at this point. It was apparently substantial, judging from his reactions to it. He experienced the usual hallucinations that a person experiences, but he had no idea what was happening to him. For that 1 month period of time, nobody told him what was happening to him. When he left the Army base, nobody debriefed him. He went back to his active duty services. He continued to have flashback recurrences on his active duty services. He went for months and years doubting his own sanity, but he was afraid to say anything to anybody for fear that he'd be discharged from the military service. The complaint alleges that, and I think the damages are important in this case because of the alternative remedy that the government alleges, which is why I'm getting into the damages. The complaint alleges that on one occasion, in fact, he even awoke late at night in a rage without any provocation, beat up his wife and beat up his children and threw the TV through the wall and went back to sleep and woke up again the next morning and had no recall of that event. The complaint also alleges that as a result of the LSD testing, he was unable to efficiently perform his duties in the military. He would be absent without leave for periods of time and would suddenly show up, and when he was questioned as to his whereabouts, he couldn't explain his whereabouts, and he was eventually reduced in rank in the military because of inefficiency. I should mention that up until the drug testing, he was in the Army for about 7 years and had an unblemished record in the Army, and he had intended to make the military his career. It was not until 7 years after he retired from military service, which is 18 years after the drug testing, that he finally got a letter from Walter Reed Medical Center telling him for the first time that he had been an unwitting LSD subject back in the late 1950s, and the purpose of that letter was to solicit him to go back up to Walter Reed now to do follow-up studies of the long-range effects of LSD. When he learned that, he filed administrative claims with the United States Army Claims Service. Those administrative claims were denied by the claim service with the statement that there is no appropriation available to the Army to pay this kind of a claim. And the Army told them, if you're dissatisfied with this determination, you have 6 months to file a lawsuit in federal district court, which is what he did. They didn't tell him, go seek veterans benefits. They told him to file a lawsuit in federal court. Now, we've alleged, to answer the question asked earlier.
He made this claim with the Army.
Made this claim with the Army Claims Service.
Well, he thought the Army had something to do with the program at that stage.
Initially,
you're now telling us you're not sure that it was even the Army.
Well, we're alleging that the program was certainly the Army was involved in the program. We are claiming the program was actually implemented by non-military defendants. We're just on the case is coming up to appeal just on the pleadings because this is not a summary judgment. There's no evidence in the record. The case got to the 11th Circuit. on a motion to dismiss the complaint based on the allegations.
I assume that all you're telling us is in the record. All the stuff you're telling us is not all extra record material.
Everything I'm telling you is either in materials that were filed with the district court when there was an earlier summary judgment motion years ago. There were some documentary materials filed with the district court, and what I'm telling you also comes out of the allegations in the complaint, so it is in the record. I've indicated who we are suing in this case. We are not the complaint itself does not purport to sue superior military officers within the disciplinary context that this court was speaking about in the Chappelle versus Wallace case, and on the government's motion to dismiss the complaint, as the allegations of the complaint should be deemed to be true. The CIA's own records about their involvement in drug testing programs in general back in the 50s were unfortunately destroyed back in 1973 pursuant to orders of the director of the CIA, who is also a defendant in this lawsuit. And we have not been able to engage in discovery to any great extent in this case because the district judge entered several orders protecting the government from discovery until we've disposed of the Ferries issue. What we're asking at this point is the opportunity to go back to district court and to prove the allegations that we're making in our complaint. And it's our position that this case falls outside of the typical Ferries factual paradigm, is the phrase that was used by the 11th Circuit in this case, and that this is not the type of claim that would require the judicial involvement into a sensitive military issues at the expense of military discipline. The very worst fact that we have to deal with in this case is that this program, whoever implemented the program, occurred on an Army base, and there's no dispute about that. Edgewood Arsenal is an Army base. But this court held in the Shearer case that the site of the incident is not nearly as important as whether the case taking the case in a complete perspective, whether that case requires a civilian court to second-guess the wisdom of military decisions. And this court said that Ferries today is best explained by the military discipline rationale and that it can't be reduced to just a few bright-line rules as to whether an incident occurred on an Army base or off of an Army base. Now, the lower courts in this case, both the district court and the Circuit Court of Appeals, have held that this is clearly not just your garden variety Ferries type of case. The facts of this case read like they've been lifted out of a novel by George Orwell, where even a person's own creative thought process is tinkered with by the government and altered and controlled by the government. And we believe that the Constitution of the United States, if it guarantees anything, surely it guarantees the right of all Americans to control their own mind and to control their own intellectual thought process and the content of their own bloodstream. That's where these constitutional claims come from.
So when they were interviewing him, and they said, by the way, will you drink this glass of liquid that has LSD in it, and we just want to see how it affects you.
That would have made,
and he just, down he went.
That would have made a substantial amount of difference, because then you wouldn't have a violation of the Nuremberg Code, because you wouldn't have an unwitting test subject. You would have a soldier who was then volunteering for what he understands to be a program to test LSD drugs. That would make all the difference in the world in a case like this, yes. Again, it's undisputed, I believe, it's undisputed.
I think you probably still would have been suing for giving him LSD without telling him what it might do to him.
Well, the Army says that back in the early or late 50s that they themselves didn't know what it would do to him. In fact, they say they thought that it would just be temporary.
So if they'd have said, by the way, this is LSD, and he would have shaken his head and said, so what?
Well,
Nobody knew what LSD was.
Then whether or not there would be a negligence cause of action is, I'm not sure there would be a constitutional cause of action. That's the point, because you see...
How about the tort claims?
Well, on the tort claims, the tort claims come under the Federal Tort Claims Act. We say that because this type of a program was patently illegal, first of all, the Nuremberg Code prohibits involuntary human experimentation.
Does the Nuremberg Code have the effect of law, civil or positive law in the United States?
Well, it's been adopted by the Chief and the Secretary of the Army and the Navy and the Air Force, and it therefore is part of the Army's own regulations. That goes to the question, do we have to second-guess the wisdom of military decisions? The military itself has already made its own regulations in this case, not only through the Nuremberg Code, but the Inspector General of the Army has issued a report on these drug experiments, and the Inspector General himself has found that this program was completely unauthorized by any existing Army regulation.
Of course, we don't know. It's true of many claims that are barred by the Ferris Doctrine. There may be something contrary to regulations, and the fact that it's contrary to regulations doesn't avoid the Ferris Doctrine.
We also think is one additional.
No, does it?
Does
the fact that our military conduct violates regulations avoid the Ferris Doctrine?
It doesn't necessarily avoid it, but it's a significant factor, because the question is whether or not do the civil courts have to second-guess military decisions?
We don't really know that this was in violation of Army regulations anyway, because you've told us that we don't really know that the Army was conducting this. And if the Army wasn't conducting it, I presume whoever was conducting it didn't have to comply with Army regulations.
The Army was, we're saying that it was not initially implemented by the Army. It did happen on an Army base. There were Army officers there. There were civilian officers there. The Inspector General himself has found that these Edgewood
Army regulations apply wherever there are Army officers. Is that how the regulations read?
Well,
I assume they only govern the activities of the Army.
The Inspector General felt that the programs were that this was an unauthorized program, that the Army was involved with. We don't know.
It was an Army program, don't you?
We don't know.
Then I don't know what you're talking about Army regulations for.
Well, the regulations of the Army should, at the very least, govern the Army in whatever program the Army, if it's going to have Army personnel involved in a program, even if the personnel is implemented by a separate branch of the government. It would seem that the Army should follow its own regulations. We have alleged that this does violate the Army's own regulations. We've also alleged one other important.
Why did it?
Because it involved unwitting human experimentation, which violates the Nuremberg Code, and because there were no regulations, according to the Inspector General, which even authorized this type of a program for the Army.
So the regulations just bar any kind of experiments with
involuntary human experiments.
Is the government responsible for unauthorized programs?
The government, we think the government is responsible when government agents violate, within the course of their employment for the government, violate constitutional rights of servicemen or civilians, that the government is responsible if the case itself does not fall within the typical Ferry's factual paradigm, one military officer suing another military officer for negligence within the course of a...
Well, this military officer walks up to a guy and says, hey, I'm going to shoot you with some LSD. Is the government responsible for that?
We think that the government is responsible for that, particularly
really?
Particularly when the government...
You don't particularly with my questions. You use what you have. Without more, the government is responsible.
If the government...
Without more. So your if is out.
Well, then your hypothetical assumes that he was told that it's LSD.
That he's what?
That the serviceman was told that it was LSD he was being shot with?
Yeah.
Okay, under those circumstances, I don't know if there is a tort claim. Unless it maybe would be failure to warn, failure to warn of what the effects of the...
My point is, up until now, you have not been able to show that this was authorized.
We allege that it was not authorized, in fact, the program. We also allege that the government, that within the context of the Ferries Doctrine, there is room for equitable principles and that there is room for an estoppel against the government. When the government is engaged in this type of unconscionable conduct, and when a military serviceman detrimentally relies upon the government telling him that he's volunteering for one kind of a program, all the while just intending to secretly mix LSD with his drinking water, under these limited circumstances, that the government should be held to be stopped to even argue that this was incident to military service. Now, this court has never intimated, I don't believe, in any Ferries case, that equitable estoppel cannot apply.
What was the last case in which we held the government was estopped?
The last case was a case where actually the majority left the question open.
So that really wouldn't be an answer to my question, then, would it?
This court has never held
the government was estopped.
That's true, but in Heckler versus Community Health, the majority opinion of this court held that there may be a case someday where the public interest would warrant an estoppel against the government. This court, I say this is it. I say this is it. I think that by finding an estoppel in this case, number one, you would not be undermining the viability of the Ferries Doctrine in general, because this is a very limited case. You would not be opening up a floodgate for other litigants, only those litigants that are similarly situated to Mr. Stanley. And if this program had been what it was described to be, if it had been really a program to test gas masks and protective clothing, and if Mr. Stanley had been injured inhaling fumes from a gas mask, then, again, the government would have a much better argument that this was incident to his military service. This is what he volunteered for. But when we say that when the government intentionally misleads its own servicemen to volunteer for one kind of a program, and that's not the program that he's really volunteering for, that the government should be stopped to argue that this is something that's incident to his military service. At any rate, we think the circumstances of this case do not involve the type of close military judgment calls that the Ferries Doctrine was really designed to insulate from review, and we don't believe that the prosecution of this claim would undermine the disciplinary structure of the military to allow it to proceed. As far as the Bivens action, even if the Ferries Doctrine does preclude our claim against the government, it would not necessarily preclude the constitutional claim against the individual defendants. The government relies upon Chappelle versus Wallace. Yes, this is the I'm getting to the Bivens argument now, Your Honor. This case is much different than the Chappelle or the Chapel case. The Chappelle case involved soldiers who were clearly superior military officers who were on board a Navy combat vessel along with the plaintiffs, and they were being sued specifically for making certain command decisions and taking certain disciplinary actions that were alleged to be racially motivated. Now, those facts are radically different from the facts that we have involved in this case. And this court in Chappelle specifically cautioned that the opinion should not be read to mean that military personnel are barred from seeking all redress in the civil courts for all kinds of constitutional violations that they may suffer in the course of military service. I think a fair reading of the Chappelle case would lead the court to believe that it was really intended to be limited to the facts that were before this court in that case. Now, the government here says that this case could involve an inquiry somehow into military decision-making somewhere along the line. Maybe there was some military decision-making involved here. But if you accept that, if that alone precludes a Bivens action, then what you're saying is that no matter what kind of a wrongful act is perpetrated on an active-duty serviceman, the individual defendants can always remain immune simply by asserting that their act was the result of military decision-making. Boom, they're immune. To accept the government's
Think that we should instead hold that they're only immune no matter what kind of wrongful act if they are superior officers? I mean, does that strike you as less heinous?
It strikes me as...
You know, it's either line sounds pretty arbitrary.
Well, I'm taking the view that a line...
The gravity of the act has nothing to do with where you draw the line, it seems to me. The gravity of the act.
Well,
nothing to do with whether you draw the lines with superior officers or not.
I think if it involves a potential estoppel situation, it should. I think that is where you should draw the line. There has to be, unless you draw the line no place, then surely the situation that you're left with is that there is absolutely no limit to the immunity doctrine without an arbitrary line someplace. And a line doesn't have to be so arbitrary, when you have facts like this. I think when federal officers willfully and knowingly violate the constitutional rights of active duty servicemen, to say that there is absolute immunity in that type of a situation, number one, that's not going to promote discipline in the military. The whole purpose of the Ferries Doctrine is to promote discipline.
Beats up a subordinate and really beats him up. And is there a Bivens action?
I think that there could be a potential Bivens action. If an officer, let's say an officer kills an active duty
deliberately, he just deliberately beats him up. And it's not negligent or anything. He just does it on purpose. And it's in violation of all the regulations. Is there a Federal Tort Claims Act?
Whether there's a Federal Tort Claims Act because of certain exclusions for some intentional torts and assault and battery is hard to say.
You think the Ferries Doctrine would bar that?
I don't think the Ferries Doctrine should because
does it or not? Has it been held that or what?
I don't know that there's been a case of intentional beating up of a inferior officer to test that, but I do think this. I think that when you consider the purpose of the Ferries Doctrine, which is to maintain discipline, okay, and you say that superior officers can do anything they want to active duty servicemen, and they need never fear of being held accountable for damages in the civil justice system, that's not going to promote discipline in the military. That's
what do you think
chaos.
What do you think the first doctrine says? They can only do what? Moderately bad things?
No, I think the Ferries Doctrine should apply in cases where the facts of the case are such that if you allow that particular type of case, if it falls outside a typical Ferries situation, if you allow that kind of case to go into the civil justice system, then it will have a negative impact on discipline.
It'll always have a negative impact. You don't think the officer is going to admit he beat him up? He's always going to say, I didn't beat him up. I mean, you know, you're talking lawsuits here, not acknowledged guilt.
If you allow...
It's going to get into the civil court system whether you're suing him for beating him up or whether you're suing him for calling him a name. It's going to disrupt the military discipline, isn't it?
If you allow those kind of claims to go forward, I don't think it will disrupt discipline. In fact, I think it will promote discipline because then inferior servicemen, enlisted men, can then obey military orders without any fear that there's going to be some kind of undetected harm that's going to befall them, like swallowing LSD. I think you've got to look at the facts of the case. I think you have to consider discipline not only at the level of the enlisted man, but I think you need to consider discipline at the higher echelon levels of the government as well. The government's interpretation, strict interpretation of the Chappelle Doctrine, would also mean that an American serviceman like Mr. Stanley, a sergeant in the Army, would be actually reduced to a position inferior even to a convicted and incarcerated federal prisoner who is allowed to bring an FTCA action and a Bivens action against prison officials.
Why not limit Ferez to medical?
Limit it to medical malpractice cases? I think Congress is trying to open it up for medical malpractice cases, in fact. But I think that Ferry should be limited to those cases where the rationale of the doctrine applies. That's the cases that it should be limited to. It should be limited to those cases where the rationale of the doctrine applies. Veterans' benefits were mentioned briefly as being...
It certainly applies in negligence cases, doesn't it?
It applies in most negligence cases, yes. I don't think it applies at all in this kind of a case. I don't think...
How does that ever affect discipline if some officer just is negligent?
I have trouble realizing how,
so when
how a medical
Ferries
malpractice
ever applies,
case...
It doesn't apply to intentional things? Doesn't apply to negligence?
Where it should apply most often is in cases where a soldier is suing a superior officer for orders that were given, or like in the Chappelle case, for giving them poor performance evaluations and for keeping them from being promoted within the Navy, and for command decisions in the military services. Surely it's clear in those cases that the military courts is the proper forum to hear those kind of cases. But when you have a fact situation which involves widespread egregious conduct. The government admits they did this. They admit to at least 1,000 servicemen that they did this to. They've admitted this.
Well, a serviceman sues, claiming that he was riding in an airplane with his superior who was piloting, and the superior was just negligent, and they crashed, and he was hurt.
There's a stronger argument for applying the Ferries Doctrine in that kind of a case.
What military discipline's involved in that?
Well, because if upper-level servicemen had to be afraid all the time of any negligent acts that they might take, that they might be hauled into a civil court, they'd be afraid to do anything. It would have such a chilling effect on higher-level servicemen that certain negligence cases, it does comport with the rationale of Ferries. But an intentional violation of constitutional rights, if you're taking the Ferries Doctrine...
Or anything that could be... All you have to do to get around that is to allege in your complaint that it was intentional...
Well, this is not just a matter of artful pleading in a case like this. This obviously he was given LSD. Nobody accidentally dropped LSD in his drinking water. He was intentionally given LSD, and according to the and he was intentionally denied the knowledge that he was given LSD. I guess artful pleading cases would have to be separated from the true intentional tort cases or intentional constitutional violation cases. But I think that when you have a situation like this where there also is no adequate remedy by veterans' benefits, if I could just spend one moment on that, the government has indicated that they think that veterans' benefits in this case would be an adequate alternative remedy, and therefore that's another reason why he shouldn't be able to sue. It's necessary to consider the type of injury that's been done here. Mr. Stanley alleges that he's been deprived of some of his most basic constitutional rights, including the right to control his own mind and his own behavior, and the right to control his own intellectual thought process. He suffered mental anguish for all the years that he thought he was going crazy. He suffered the disruption of his Army career. His family and marriage has been dissolved and broken down. There are no veterans' benefits that can compensate for these kind of injuries. Veterans' benefits also will not serve a deterrent purpose, which is one of the most important purposes behind the Bivens action, is to discourage this type of shocking abuse of power by federal officials. Veterans' benefits don't do that. At this stage, it's almost 30 years after those 1958 drug experiments. About the only thing that veterans' benefits can do for Mr. Stanley now maybe is pay for any future psychiatric care that he might need, but he's not having flashbacks anymore. That will be nil. Veterans' benefits won't do anything for him. In the Chappelle case, this court found that the administrative remedies would be adequate. Again, in that case, those plaintiffs were saying that they were discriminated against, and this court found that they could administratively receive pay increases and retroactive pay increases and promotions, and they could receive everything administratively that they were asking for in the civil lawsuit. You also said on the same day that Chappelle was decided in Bush versus Lucas that before an alternative remedy is considered to be a special factor militating against allowing a Bivens action, it should at least provide meaningful remedies for a plaintiff. Meaningful remedies. We have no meaningful remedies provided in this case. The VA, the Veterans Benefits Act, was never meant by Congress to be an exclusive remedy. There is no exclusive remedy provision. In fact, that act expressly recognizes the possibility of double recovery because there's a provision in the Veterans Act which provides a method for offsetting cumulative recoveries. And this court held in the Brooks case and the Brown case that a veteran who receives VA benefits is still not necessarily precluded from suing. One important point in conclusion also is that in a Bivens action, defendants are always entitled to raise a qualified immunity. If they say they acted in good faith, and if they reasonably believe their conduct to be lawful, just like in a civil rights case, then they're immune. But if this court gives these defendants, under these kind of facts, an absolute immunity for the act that they've done, no matter the message will be that no matter what a serviceman does to a lower echelon serviceman, then they need never fear of being brought into the civil justice system. And I think that after all the progress that's been made since Bivens in the last 15 years with Bivens and Carlson versus Green and United States versus Muniz and so on, to recognize an absolute immunity from liability in an egregious case like this would be a step in the wrong direction. And we ask this court to affirm the 11th Circuit's decision.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Cuffer. Mr. Wright, you have 14 minutes remaining.
Just a few comments, please. We've been faced with something of a moving target on the facts here, and I'd just like to quote from the second amended complaint, which is reprinted in the joint appendix, that in paragraph 11 on page 6 says that respondent was, quote, on active duty at the time he suffered the wrongful act here. And on the next page in paragraph 14 says that the defendants were acting under cover of a covert federal army program, and that it was the official policy that is responsible for the deprivation of his rights. We take that to mean that this was an army program. We don't think that there's any real question that it was an army program. And respondent has...
Did the regulations giving him LSD or not?
No, but I'd like to mention the respondent has mischaracterized that. The Inspector General did issue a report, which is not in the record in this case, is not a public document, which admits that a number of violations were made, but it nowhere suggests that testing chemical weapons was wrong. Mm-hmm. It does suggest that the consent forms used here and the debriefing that was done here was not done the way it should have been done. But there are regulations that say that chemical weapons
tests can be done. Was there any consent form involved in this?
We don't have the facts on this. The Senate report concerning the program prints one of the sorts of consent forms that were used in this program, which the Senate criticized. But in any event...
Certainly the government never had a program of experiment with LSD. Or did it?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did our government have a program of experimenting with LSD?
Yes, it did.
On soldiers?
Yes, it did.
That's admitted?
Yes. And there's no question about that. Concerning the volunteer point, I'd like to mention only that we've returned to a prior stage. The Fifth Circuit discussed respondents' volunteer point in its 1981 opinion in the portion reprinted at pages 72 to 74 of the appendix to the petition, and we think that makes it perfectly clear that the fact that he was or wasn't a volunteer, I'm not sure exactly what respondents' point is, doesn't matter in this case. As a final point, an estoppel argument was raised in respondents' argument. That's never been raised in this case at any point before, including the briefs in this court.
Are there cases that bar a Federal Tort Claims Act for intentional torts?
Well, there's an intentional tort exception to the Federal Tort Claims Act. I think it's 2680
right.
each.
Right. And so it'd just be sovereign immunity then.
The government has not waived sovereign immunity for intentional torts.
How about suits against the officers?
I'm not sure that an intentional tort of the sort somebody hits somebody has actually come up. Chappell v. Wallace, I suppose race discrimination is a form of intentional tort, although it's not your run-of-the-mill form of intentional tort.
Well, there isn't is there any federal jurisdiction over an ordinary tort claim of one military personnel over another? It's not really a 1983 action. It's not a Federal Tort Claims action because the Federal Tort Claims Act provides that the United States is the defendant in substitution for everyone else.
That's right. In a case where one serviceman happened to hit another off base at a bar or something, I suppose.
What about on base?
Well, I'm sure we'd get into disputes about these matters, but one would think that that would be a normal state law cause of action that one serviceman might have against another. If there are no further questions.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. The case is submitted.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.